Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton. I am the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. And to indicate you have a question, you're just going to simply press the number 1 on your telephone keypad, and you'll be placed in the queue to be on the air. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. The school-to-prison pipeline refers to the policies and practices that push our nation's children, especially our most at risk, out of classrooms and into the juvenile and adult criminal justice systems. In 1954, Chief Justice Warren wrote in the landmark Brown v. Board of Education decision, "It is doubtful that any child may reasonably be expected to succeed in life if he is denied the opportunities of an education. Such an opportunity where the state has undertaken to provide it is a right that must be made available on equal terms." Unfortunately, in 2015, the right to a public education for some youth remains elusive. Many schools have become gateways to the juvenile justice system by implementing zero-tolerance policies that automatically impose severe punishment, regardless of circumstances, and by placing increased reliance on police, including hiring school resource officers to patrol hallways. As a result, far too often students are suspended, expelled, or even arrested for minor offenses, the majority of which are nonviolent. Statistics reflect that these policies disproportionately target students of color and those with a history of abuse, neglect, poverty, or learning disabilities. For example, it has been reported that African American students are suspended and expelled at a rate 3 times greater than Caucasian students, and African American and Latino students account for 70% of police referrals. Suspensions are even occurring at the preschool level. So let's be clear, a school suspension can be life-altering. It's a high predictor, if not the number one predictor, more than poverty, of whether children will drop out of school and have a life that includes greater likelihood of unemployment, reliance on social welfare programs, and imprisonment. In 2013, the National Education Association made a formal commitment to close the pipeline, and last year the U.S. Department of Justice ordered school districts to respond to student misbehavior in fair, non-discriminatory, and effective ways. Today we have 3 guests here to discuss this important issue. Rebecca Ballard DiLoretto is the Kentucky Litigation and Policy Director for the Children's Law Center. Rebecca works in the areas of juvenile justice, child welfare, education law, and mental health. She previously worked with the Kentucky Department of Public Advocacy and Indigent Defense, where she created the Juvenile Post-Disposition Branch, and she directed the Lexington Public Defender's Office. Rebecca also teaches at Chase College of Law, the University of Kentucky College of Law, and the University of College of Social Work. Dennis Parker is the director of the National ACLU's Racial Justice Program. In that role, he oversees work to combat the school-to-prison pipeline, the profiling of airline passengers subjected to searches and wrongfully placed on watch lists, and the racial bias in the criminal justice system. Previously, Dennis worked as the chief of the New York State Attorney General's Civil Rights Bureau and as a staff attorney at NACCP Legal Defense Fund. He publishes and lectures extensively about civil rights and is an adjunct professor at the New York Law School. Dr. Bria Perry is an associate professor of sociology at Indiana University. Previously, she was an associate professor at the University of Kentucky, where she founded and directed the Interdisciplinary Health Society and Populations Program. Her research examines the intersections of social inequality, social networks, well-being, and life chances. Her recent study published in American Sociological Review on the collateral consequences of punitive school environments and was funded by the Spencer Foundation and covered by numerous media outlets. So I'd like to welcome the 3 of you to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So, Dennis, I think I'd like to hear from you first, especially since you have a national perspective here. I did a very brief introduction to this issue, but what more can you tell our listeners about the school-to-prison pipeline?
I think there are a couple of important things, and one of them is that everyone obviously wants schools to be safe and want them to be positive learning places for all of the kids. I think that a lot of the things that you described, the zero tolerance policy, the overuse of police and school resource officers in the school, were driven by a perception of schools which is itself false. You know, there is a sense that schools are these extremely dangerous places, that crime is steadily rising in the schools, and that is not the case nationally. And I think the other false premise is the idea that if you have these draconian kind of measures, that you create safer schools, that those are effective measures. And I think that the evidence shows that there are negative consequences from these sorts of tools, zero tolerance and things like that, that they undercut the learning environment, but perhaps most significantly, they're not even the best ways to assure safe school environments. So I think it's important that people need to step back and take a broader look at, you know, why we don't want to convert our schools into correctional facilities, and why we need to think about, you know, how do you create a safe and effective school?
Rebecca Breed, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, I think it's important to consider the political strength of the school in many communities, and perhaps most particularly in our smaller, more rural communities, because they are a significant source of employment. That plays a role systemically, because what we can find is that more and more behaviors of children that when I was a kid wouldn't have been seen as criminal have become criminal, and it's really a way to maintain control, but as Dennis said, it is misguided because it doesn't solve the problems of the misbehavior, but usually aggravates it.
I agree. This is Bria. I think it's really important to emphasize the psychological toll that exclusionary discipline like suspension and expulsion takes on kids and adolescents, particularly as it starts earlier and earlier. You mentioned suspensions from preschool. And by and large, students who've been suspended feel angry and unfairly punished. They don't feel remorseful about their suspension. And this, in turn, can lead to a weakening of school bonds and a disinvestment in education, and, in fact, a disinvestment in society that can last a lifetime. So really, you're just creating more problems, more deviance, when you take this sort of approach.
And before we move on, is there anything, I mean, Dennis, you talked about it a little bit, anything more you want to say about where these type of policies started? And I mean, I've heard even people talk about that some of this may be to boost overall test scores of schools because of pressures they're under. So I don't know if anyone has anything you want to add about where this began.
There really are a wide range of things that I think have driven it. And you are correct. I know that in New York City, Advocates for Children did a study that showed certain high schools, because of the pressures that were exerted on schools by No Child Left Behind, particularly in the early years, were finding reasons to push children out of school before test days so that they wouldn't have to worry about suffering the consequences of having these students do poorly on tests. So that pressure to perform is one driving factor. Another major thing that happened is that in the wake of Columbine and some of the other tragedies in schools, the reaction was for the federal government to make available large amounts of money to bring police officers and school resource officers into schools at a much greater rate than they were before. And I think that one of the legacies of that, we did a study in Connecticut where we looked at three towns and found that the schools that had not had problems before, when there were more law enforcement officers in the schools, that there were far more kids being suspended and expelled and being sent to the police station in a number of the school districts. So I think that there was this sort of rush in, and from school districts, there was this money made available, and you know, I guess they felt they had to take it, and it ended up creating a presence in the schools that were not always positive, and in fact usually negative. And the extreme effect of that is that, you know, you now read about schools where police officers are carrying tasers or things like that, and you know, that's obviously not a good development.
Yeah, I agree, and I think sociologists would look at the cause of this being even broader as more of a societal shift. Over the past 30 years or so, we've identified a profound shift towards the emphasis on crime punishment and social control in U.S. society that's sometimes been called the culture of control. And it's characterized by, you know, increasing fear of crime, increased desire for retribution-like punishments, and it's expanded the scope of policies that are exclusionary or social exclusion. And these are sort of control-oriented approaches to crime in general, or deviance in general, are exemplified by policies like the War on Drugs campaign and three strikes laws that have contributed to about a fourfold increase in incarceration rates since the 1970s. And so what we sort of look at this as a broader trend or shift in society that's just now sort of leaking into other institutions like schools.
Okay. So what brought each of you to this issue? Why did you want to become involved in it? Rebecca, why don't you start us off?
Well, honestly, the reason I wanted to become involved is because I saw too many children in our juvenile courts who came in with black eyes and sometimes choke marks and bruising from events that happened to them in encounters with adults at their schools, and the children were charged with offenses in court. And you knew that you were not getting the whole story with respect to how the children were treated. And those children were most typically in alternative school placements. So they had already been pushed out of the regular schools and placed in alternative programs, which are designed really as an additional exclusionary step to remove them from the regular classroom and regular education.
Kim?
The reason that I got involved basically was Rebecca. It's Rebecca's fault. She contacted our department to request some statistical consulting, and I ended up getting involved that way, and the process sort of snowballed. And you know, there was a link because I do study racial health disparities, but it wasn't really the sort of thing that I typically would have studied, but I just became more and more interested when I learned about the scope of the problem. And then a couple of years into the project with Rebecca and the Children's Law Center, my sister adopted two babies from Ethiopia. So at that point, the whole issue became very personal. And I was looking at these data and seeing all the challenges faced particularly by black boys in the American public education system, even among those that come from middle-class families, I should point out. And it makes me very afraid for my nephews and what they're going to face in the future. And they're almost five now, and one of them is very spirited. So I'm a little concerned about what's going to happen to him, to be honest.
Dennis?
One of the things, for about 10 or 15 years, I had worked in the South doing school desegregation cases, which frequently involved going into schools and looking at a whole set of different data dealing with education. And one of the things that we saw consistently, and this was a time when there were 300-plus school desegregation cases still pending in the federal courts, is that if you ask for discipline data, that there were always these racial disparities. And when you dug down deeper into it, it became clear that there was sometimes outright discrimination, you know, a fight between a black kid and a white kid, and the black kid would be suspended and the white kid not suspended, or in some cases more subtle things. And so it became clear that this was a problem, certainly in those Southern desegregation cases. But when I came here to the ACLU, and started speaking with our affiliates, we were hearing the same thing from all over the country, that there were these policies that were extremely harmful, that were pushing kids out of schools, in some cases placing them in alternative schools, where when we went to check out what was going on, we'd find that a kid would be sent to an alternative school where there was essentially no instruction going on. They'd return to their regular school sometimes and find that they had fallen even further behind, which frequently led to more problems. And so it created the spiral, which pretty much guaranteed that these kids wouldn't graduate. And as we began to look at a lot of the education concerns came out of these policies and resulted in things which didn't make sense. You know, kids who were truant being punished by being expelled from schools. You know, things that ended up being not only not good for the kids and not good for the schools, but not good for the communities. You know, you had kids who were not supervised now, you know, out in the streets and things like that. So it became clear that this was a problem that, as you said in the beginning, was having just a huge effect on the opportunity of individual students and ultimately on the communities in which they lived.
Bria, you mentioned that, you know, you got involved in this because of Rebecca. So the two of you have really been doing research and working to look at this, of what's happening in Kentucky. So what did you find as what's happening, and what have you been doing to address it?
So I would say that our findings center on sort of three main themes. So the first is that the data from Kentucky, which are fairly representative of what's going on nationally, I should say. So even though we're talking about Kentucky, I think these things can be applied to most places in the United States. But the data really suggest a culture of control that's characterized by overuse of exclusionary discipline. And we're seeing exclusionary discipline being used increasingly for insubordination and other minor infractions. So there ends up being a real disconnect between the punishment and the crime. So for example, in Kentucky data, about 41% of suspensions are for disruptive behavior and 22% are for truancy. It makes no sense to me to suspend a kid for truancy, but, you know, what do I know? Only about 4% of suspensions annually are due to more serious and threatening violations like possession of a weapon or drugs. So suspension is being used liberally for offenses, really that can be effectively managed through other strategies like peer mediation or counseling and other interventions. The second sort of finding is that we see strong racial disparities similar to what we see elsewhere in the country. So black youth in Kentucky are about 6 times as likely as whites to be suspended overall, and they're about 3 times as likely to be suspended after you account for socioeconomic differences across groups, and that mirrors the you know, 3 times the risk that you mentioned earlier. And I guess more importantly than that, we find that these racial disparities in punishment have important implications for the racial gap in achievement, too. So we find that being personally suspended initiates a trajectory of really academic decline from which kids never recover, even if they're only suspended once. So we find that overall racial disparities in punishment explain about 20% of the racial achievement gap in test scores. And then the third sort of big take-home finding is the American Sociological Review piece that you mentioned, which suggests essentially that exclusionary discipline harms even non-punished kids. So when suspensions increase in a school in a given semester, even non-suspended children perform more poorly on standardized tests in reading and math relative to other semesters, so relative to their own performance in other semesters when the school is less punitive. So, and this effect is net of the overall level of violence and disruptive incidents in the schools, which suggests really that there's some additional negative impact of the punitive culture itself on kids' performance and ability to learn. And those are really the three sort of big findings.
Right. So then, Rebecca, with these sort of horrific findings, what are you doing, like, on the ground and then also, like, on a state policy level about this?
Sure. Well, because of the work that Bria and Ed Morris did on these issues at UK Department of Sociology, we were able to take their findings and go to the Kentucky Department of Education and some of the larger school districts, and we have gone after trying to help improve the top 10 districts that had disparate exclusionary discipline practices. And we've also been able to go after the data which shows, you know, court charging and alternative school placement. So we use suspension data, court charging data, and alternative suspension data. And our goal was to help the schools see that there were other options. And the federal government has also provided, through the U.S. Department of Ed, resources in that respect, so that we brought to the schools proposals for using, as Bria said, you know, in addition to peer mediation, positive behavior intervention strategy training for the teachers and school personnel, restorative justice opportunity and training for students and school personnel, turning to places like the Safer, Saner Schools for assistance, and working with schools to have them examine their codes of conduct and whether, as Bria said, do they really need to be choosing the most severe punishments and exclusionary punishments for acts that are not a threat to public safety. I'll offer an example. One of the, because of my work in this area on the systemic level, I had a judge call me. She had a child in Kentucky locked up for 8 days in jail for not going to school, and she had brought him back to court, and he told her he wasn't going to go to school because they weren't helping him any. So she asked me, would I go, you know, talk with him and represent him? And it is, you know, such a struggle to get systems to change in how they see children. The school didn't want to help him because they said, well, he'd smoked marijuana before, so therefore we don't have to evaluate him, you know, for any special education services because he's we're exempted from that given his drug use. He'd had repeated encounters with an assistant principal who worked in the child's mind to aggravate the child. And this child's a classic example of how, you know, what being locked up for such a minor offense was so confusing to him. He was locked up with kids because of the way in which many of the country's detention facilities work. They don't separate. They don't have a lockup facility for low-level offenders pre-trial and another one for more serious offenders. So he was locked up with a whole variety of children charged with different offenses, and none of that was a positive experience for him. And then, you know, the school not being willing to see their need to assist him wasn't positive. So, what we've tried to do with bringing forth systemic changes is to get them to change their perspective. I can speak later about the challenges that the courts, you know, present to us in litigating these issues, but we've had success in getting schools to look at the studies that people like Dennis and Bria have brought forward and try to bring forth a plan for change. It's a challenge to stay on top of it and you know, keep moving it forward, but we have made some progress.
So Dennis, you're working on a national level on this, and you just heard what's been happening in Kentucky. Is this consistent, and what are some of the trends that you're seeing? And I think for our audience, it's always very helpful if you can give some concrete example of what's happened to some kids
Sure.
The policies we're talking about, and then maybe what's happening now with jurisdictions that are trying to change that, you know.
Right. Well, these are trends that are nationwide. They're not limited to Kentucky. And some of the trends are, as you mentioned at the beginning, that we're seeing younger and younger kids who are being pulled into this. And so, you may have seen the video of the 5-year-old girl in, I believe it was Georgia, who was put in handcuffs when she had a temper tantrum in her school. And there are continual reports that are like that, reports coming from preschools about kids being suspended from, you know, at age 4. You know, with these are, you know, imagine if your first memory of school was having a police officer called on you. You know, that would be just a horrible experience. You know, we had for a long time collected instances because of really mindless applications of zero tolerance policies. You know, kids who had, you know, things that were clearly not weapons, you know, being kicked out of school. In New York City, we did a series of interviews with students, and some of them described how they were studying drafting and had the school resource officers seize from them drafting tools because they thought they were weapons. And as well as these students talking about what it does to them to have to go through metal detectors and be wanded and frisked sometime every day just to get into school. And when that was happening, they would describe instances where the school resource officers were disrespectful to them, would call them baby Rikers after Rikers Island, the correctional institution here in New York, which basically demonstrated what the expectation was for these students. And you know, again, you can imagine what effect that has on a young child going in and being treated preemptively as if he or she were a criminal. I think that one of the positive things is the attention that it's getting from groups, advocacy groups, and as you pointed out, from the Justice Department and the Department of Education, recognizing that this is an issue. And I think perhaps the most important thing is the availability of data in the Civil Rights Data Collection that's housed in the United States Department of Education, because it permits you to go in and look not only by the school district level, but by individual schools. One of the things that we see is that for a long time, school systems were not paying attention or in some cases not even recording data about discipline. And so we urge people, you know, and there are a lot of occasions when we have to litigate, but in those instances where we're doing public education, one of the things we keep saying is you need to look at that data. You need to see what's happening in the schools. You need to see who is disciplining children and for what. You know, one of the things that we found when we dug down deeper into the data is that kids of color are punished for different things than white students, so that kids of color are more likely to be punished for things like insubordination or disrespect, whereas white students are more likely to be punished for having a weapon or drugs or something that is, you know, more of an objective violation. And so that raises questions. You know, we've been pushing an understanding of unconscious implicit bias as one of the things that drives the disparities, and so school districts need to learn about what that means and then need to do the training necessary to counter it. But again, it's not specific to any one state or any one region of the country. It's nationwide.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, Lauren, I interject this, Rebecca?
Yeah.
You know, one of the areas of the law that I've really had to come to understand fully is that of access to mental health care. And I think the reason for it is that the schools would describe that they face all these social pressures. So I know Bria just, you know, described it as a culture of control, and that I agree with that. But if you even want to, you know, look at it from in a very sympathetic factor from the perspective of the schools, they feel bombarded, they would say, with all of the sort of social ills of our day. And then they believe that they need easier access to link children with mental health services. Well, you know, one of the things that James Bell at the Burns Institute has noted and published is the way in which we fail to understand mental health when we see them in a young African American child, and most particularly a young African American boy. Instead, we see it as aggressive action, and we immediately personified in the form of criminal activity. And what we know children are entitled to, if you understand Medicaid and you understand, you know, what services they're entitled to, so many children are entitled to wraparound services, case management, and crisis intervention. And yet, you know, the way our Medicaid system is structured in this country is that if a child's in detention, even today, if a child's in detention, in our juvenile detention facilities, they are given a higher priority to go into our mental health system, and we have got to change that. We are trying to do it in Kentucky and other places too. But that's a critical component, bringing the services to bear that are to serve children, the systems that are should be devoted to children's best interests, and get them to work together to help
and it's not just and families. You know, I agree 100%, and it's not just outside services being brought into the schools. What we see all the time is that the number of kids with disabilities who are disciplined is really disproportionately high, and frequently, again, when you look at the individual cases, the behavior that they're being punished for is completely consistent with their disability, even as outlined in their individual education plans. So basically, schools that are not providing the services that they are required to by law are then punishing kids for engaging in behavior which they know about and which they're not doing what they're required to do to address. So it's essentially punishing the kid twice.
Well, yeah. There are two
and
questions that have come in from our audience that the guests have mentioned alternate schools a few times. So if you can explain what those are and how they're connected to this issue is the first question, a little bit more.
Sure. I could speak about the alternative schools. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Alternative schools, you know, the definition differs from school district to school district. I was using it to refer to schools where students are assigned for behavioral problems, and typically students are after a certain number of infractions, are sent to another building for some period of time, presumably to get some sort of special attention to prepare them to go back to their schools. What we found is that we did studies in Mississippi, for example, where the alternative schools were schools that are staffed by people who are not certified teachers, where there wasn't grade differentiation. In one school, kids, you know, from four different grades would be sitting in a classroom copying lessons from a copy book, and, you know, told they could speak to each other or look at each other, but really no substantial education was going on. Now, there are good alternative schools. It is possible to do it in a way that recognizes that students would benefit from the change of environment, but there are many, many schools that are really alternative schools that are closer to warehouses than educational institutions.
And part of the notion of an alternative program is they call them in Kentucky, it's recognized as programs, and they're not schools in that they didn't have nearly the same reporting requirements as schools have had. And in one sense, you could say they were designed to allow school systems to have more creativity to offer students alternative paths to success in education. But because they were not, the data reporting wasn't there, and as Dennis said, all the quality could so easily be reduced, there needed to be a tightening up of that in Kentucky, and I'm sure elsewhere. In 2008, the Kentucky Department of Education couldn't even identify how many alternative programs that were being run in the state. one of the things that we've worked on is to revise the alternative education regulations so they very clearly define whether a program is a punitive one where a student's sent, as Dennis said, for punishment, or is it one that offers some other type of education, and that they're very clear for a child how a child gets into it and what a child can do to get out of it. One of the first kids I began representing in this domain was a child who had been in the alternative program for 4 years and remained in ninth grade all 4 years. And they'd never identified her as a child needing any additional instruction. You know, so, you know, our efforts were to get her an education, but she was just put there and forgotten.
And maybe just take one more minute, because this may seem maybe, you know, obvious to us, but for people who are just really learning about this for the first time, because, you know, Rebecca, you're saying trying to get them out of the alternative schools. When we're talking about the school-to-prison pipeline and the exclusionary policies, we're really talking about one direction. There's a lot of people who believe, like, so they're suspended for a little bit. I mean, the kids are not getting back into school is one of the problems, too. Does anyone want to talk about that? Go on, Dennis.
Well, no, please.
Yes, no, please, go ahead.
Okay, what I was going to say is that frequently they're not, and even if they do come back to school, they're at a greater disadvantage. You know, one of the things that drives sometimes some of the behavioral problems that result in suspensions are because the students are struggling in the schools, and so removing them from the schools does nothing to help that problem. But you know, there is also the psychic toll that it takes on kids to be identified as someone who you know shouldn't be in school or is disruptive to school, and then ultimately it comes, you know, there's a strong correlation between suspension and ultimate dropout, and then a further correlation between dropout and likelihood of being incarcerated as an adult. So it is. You know, from the very beginning, it is a real problem, and it doesn't bode well for the future of the kids.
One of the Bria, if you could speak to the your study regarding the long-term impact of suspension on academic performance, because a chart that Bria has on that has been one of the most meaningful tools I have used to help people see what academic failure looks like with suspension.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons it's successful is because, you know, with all the emphasis on standardized tests now, I think when administrators see the impact on kind of their bottom line, you know, it has an effect. But yeah, we show a chart where we show the sort of trajectory of academic decline that kids experience when they have one suspension in a year, and then a suspension in two consecutive years, and then a suspension in three consecutive years. And they go from, I'm trying to remember the exact figures, but they go from about the 52nd percentile in the beginning to about the 30th percentile at the end if they have just one suspension.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's a massive decline.
About 70. Yeah, Bria, it's about 70 at the beginning, and it goes down to 20 with the
three. Is that what, okay.
Your chart does. Yeah, I have it.
You look at it a lot more than I do.
Oh, I do. I look at it a lot. I have a client who is a kindergartner, and he is the son of a prominent African-American minister in the town where I'm working. And he has been suspended three times as a kindergartner, one for squeezing the teacher's hand too hard, you know, one for disruption in the class, and one because he hit another child in the playground. And, you know, this is all in his kindergarten year, spread out.
Wow.
And, you know, as Bria said, her concern about that race really trumps other factors. You can be, you know, a middle-class child, but the race can target you. And that child's an example of that for me.
Yeah. Well, and another thing that I think is interesting that comes out of our research that I hope really prompts, you know, parents of non-suspended kids to get involved in this issue is that, you know, Dennis was talking about the psychological toll that it has on kids that are suspended, and there's actually quite a bit of research that suggests that it takes a psychological toll on non-suspended kids as well, because You have kids who are so-called rule abiders who are under a constant threat of surveillance and a constant threat of being redefined as a troublemaker. And when you have the same skin color as that other kid who's constantly getting in trouble, then it makes, you know, it makes that threat even more salient, you know, and really wreaks havoc on the child's psychological health and academic performance.
So we had another question that I'm I want to hear if there are any real promising practices happening, but a question that may sort of go along with this is, where's the public with it, you know, on this? Then she mentioned that the 5-year-old and that news story and video kind of went viral, so people saw it. But where is the public reaction to that, and is that fostering any promising practices out there?
Yeah, I think that the more that that information, you know, the more you hear about, you know, the, like the story we just heard about a kindergartner being suspended for the kind of behavior that that kindergartners engage in, I think it puts it into perspective. You know, for so long, the response to violence and crime was shaped more by the discussion from the 90s or from whenever about super predators, and people were worried about, you know, these supposedly horrible kids who were, you know, who you couldn't redeem, who were causing all these problems. And I think, you know, one of the things that the exposure that these stories gives is that this could be your kid. You know, the things that these kids are being punished for are things that are things that your kid did or that you did when you were younger. And so, you know, again, I think that the exposure, having people like the Justice Department identify this as a problem, I think is important. You know, I'm hopeful that it will be at least the beginning of some positive changes. You know, one other thing that I wish was recognized more, there were discussions before about positive behavior support and things like that. You know, I don't know how much the public is aware of the evidence that there are ways of creating safer environments that don't involve high levels of suspension, and that may result in increased safety or does result in increased safety at the schools. And I don't know whether that has gotten the attention or has attracted the attention of the public as much as, you know, maybe some more negative things have.
I do feel in Kentucky, you know, we sort of, it's kind of like the spread of chickenpox or something. I think that PBIS is spreading, and that's really positive. So that is teaching children, teaching administrators and teachers how to help, you know, how to educate children about positive behavior and how to reflect it and how to intervene in a positive way and how to de-escalate. And then the other thing we've done in Kentucky is to rewrite the regulations on the use of restraint and seclusion. Now, we aren't all the way done. We still have a few school districts where the school law enforcement officers are, you know, shackling elementary-age children that shouldn't happen in our Commonwealth. But we at least, the leaders in education recognize the importance of it, and people are petitioning school boards to address these issues. So restorative justice, different types of peer mediation, conflict resolution, positive behavior intervention strategies that Mike Wofford for the Kentucky Center for Instructional Discipline and other groups out of the Department of Education are involved with are making a difference. And then addressing the community needs so that schools understand that we are trying to bring them supports that they identify that they need in order to help these children succeed.
Yeah, I think that, you know, sort of the realization of the importance of this issue and the extent of its impact has started at the top and is sort of filtering down to the public slowly. I mean, even at the administrator level, Rebecca, I like vaguely remember that there was quite a bit of variation in terms of their response to the findings that we presented. Whereas, you know, other administrators were really open to change. And that was a very positive experience for me, especially since my kids were in that school system. But, you know, in terms of the public, I don't really know. I think there's still a lot of parents out there who think that it would never happen to their kid. And, if, you know, if the comments on some of the blogs about this that I've written or media attention that some of our research has gotten are any indication, I mean, some people really do feel like, you know, we need to get rid of these bad apples, you know, because, you know, it's fine to sacrifice a few for the good of the many, and my kid is, you know, one of the good ones. So I don't know. I mean, I think we need a systematic study about public attitudes. I think that would be really useful, actually.
Are there any other practices you want to highlight for our audience where schools and jurisdictions have implemented and schools have remained safe and there's been better outcomes for the kids?
Rebecca, do you know anything about, I was thinking about, I think one of the things that came out of our work with one of the counties or one of the public school systems was a pilot suspension diversion program.
Yes.
It was very successful, correct?
Yes.
I don't know if they've continued it, but.
Right, they have. I mean, you know, what you always have to look at, making sure that education continues to happen, because so what they've what I think many of the districts have shifted to in-school, detention, so that are in school, you could call it suspension, but they're removed from the classroom, but they're put in another educational setting for a time. And in Louisville, they've also set up something called the Transition Island, where they're helping. The goal of it is to help the child transition back into the classroom. My view would be our goal is, you know, we keep them in school and whatever ways we work to address the behavior we need to do. So I think it's much better to keep them in that educational environment than to remove them. I also think there's a lot being done to try to improve, you know, the alternative education environments. But part of the challenge of putting children outside the school is you also remove them from the opportunity for extracurriculars, which are often a kid's primary motive to even be in school. And we really have to keep those opportunities available to them. You asked, Lauren, you know, at the beginning, you know, what's our motive? And, you know, I have got three children, and I live in a community. And what I believe is if we don't give opportunity to all of our children, you know, to think that any of our children are safe or are going to flourish is nonsense. Because, I don't know, angry people and alienated people who feel alienated from the community can wreak havoc on it one way or another. And we have to build opportunity for all the children. I mean, that's what drives me. And I do think we have to help, like Bria said, the rest of the parents, you know, see that. And I think they can more easily when you look at the preschool data. You know, it's just sort of shocking to see that with, I think, preschool suspensions, they are preschool children who are African-American represent 18% of preschool enrollment, but 48% of the children who receive more than one out-of-school suspension. You know, that's preschool, not even kindergarten. So, NPR has done some great stories on that to describe children of color who've, you know, been kicked out of the classroom at 4 and 5 years of age. And something's wrong with our classroom. Maybe we need to change our sense of a classroom if that's what we are doing with kids at that age.
We have about 10 minutes left. So I'd like to hear from each of you sort of about the advice you might want to give to your peers and other professionals about how to discuss this issue, how to make changes, and any final thoughts that you may have that you want to leave with our audience. So I don't know who would like to begin.
Please go ahead.
No, go ahead, Dennis.
No, I insist.
No, I am.
You see, I'm always really worried about, you know, particularly being the only male on the call, about being too aggressive and talking over other people. So in order to try to change some of the harmful stereotypes about men, I insist that you go first.
Oh, well, I am nothing if not aggressive, so don't worry about that.
Me too.
Right, exactly. I don't know. I don't really have any advice for my peers, because my peers are social scientists and they're pretty much on board. I mean, I don't know anybody who's looking at these data or who's doing research in this area that would say that discipline procedures and public education are functioning really well right now, you know, or that mass incarceration of Black Americans isn't a crisis. So, you know, I'm not very well equipped to answer that question. But in terms of final thoughts, for me, punishment in schools, sort of going back to what Rebecca was just talking about, is such a critical issue for the future of all of our youth, because discipline really serves broader sort of symbolic, cultural, and affective functions that extend well beyond that specific act of discipline. And, you know, enforcing reasonable boundaries communicates really important meanings and values about school and about, you know, social norms, and it makes all of our kids feel secure. And then in contrast, if punishment is inappropriately harsh or even seemingly random, it really undermines the legitimacy of school rules and the people who enforce them, creating like some kind of psychological wedge between kids and authority figures during what is a really critical period of social development. And long term, I think this really just exacerbates broader racial and social inequalities that none of us want for our kids.
Dennis?
Go ahead, Dennis.
I would definitely agree with that. I think that the people who are my peers, who are the education advocates, are very aware of the issues, are aware of resources, and are trying to find ways to. You know, it's unfortunate when litigation is the only way that you could approach these huge problems. And I think that there's more and more recognition of the need to engage in conversations with educators, with school districts. And, you know, I don't think that any of this or that – I don't think much of this is because people are racist or dislike kids or things like that. And I think that, you know, part of it is finding some way to make people realize that there are better ways to do that. And I think in terms of parting comments, there's such a huge cost for this problem. There's the obvious cost to each of the individual kids and what it does to their opportunity and their ability to achieve their potential. But there's an enormous societal cost too, in terms of, you know, the prison end of the pipeline, which is an inexpensive or is an expensive and an ineffective way of dealing with crime. And then there's what we lose as a society economically and in every way. You know, you have these kids who have so much potential and could contribute so well to society. And if we write them off early, which is to some extent what we're talking about through this whole conversation, the willingness to like give up on a kid and say, there's nothing we can do other than to kick you out. You know, that's bad for all of us. And I think that's the one message that kept going through what we've been saying for this last hour. And I think it's something that people need to be aware of.
This is Rebecca. A prominent school board attorney and I were doing a debate for the public last year, and after it, he said that in terms of this school to prison pipeline issue, he said, you know, they've represented a lot of schools with school shootings. He said they did a national study regarding that, and they found that predominantly they were white males, young white males, involved in school shootings. And he said, in contrast, if you look at what we've done with respect to, you know, school policing and these exclusionary practices, the African American children are being targeted for that. And this individual represents school districts successfully across the state. But he saw this. Another expert, a sociologist who's helped me a lot in looking at these issues of disparity in treatment, has said to look, you know, look at the small things. You don't have to look at the you know, most sort of severe offenses in how children are treated, but look at the very small ones in how children are treated across all the systems. And that's where you see the, you look at it and you say, why are we doing this? And it's because I think we are habituated to it. And Bria spoke, you know, eloquently to that. I'm a lawyer, so if I were speaking to my peers, we all got ourselves educated, you know, passed grade school, high school, college, and our JD degree. So we know about the importance of equal access to opportunity. From that framework, to me, using exclusionary discipline just, you know, doesn't make sense. And habitual reliance upon ultimately incarceration as the solution is really going to do us in as a nation. So we have to turn it around. And I am hopeful. I'm much more hopeful than I was. When I started this journey, I did not expect the public in Kentucky to look at this and really consider it. But I have found in the last 3 years that they have, and I think it's because of people like Dennis, you know, at the national level, and then people like Dr. Perry, and, you know, now at her second, you know, university, who have done the studies and brought this forward in a very objective manner. So I really appreciate that effort.
And if our audience is interested in seeing the research that Bria participated in, it's on the Children's Law Center's website. If people want to know what the ACLU is doing on the school-to-prison pipeline, you can go to aclu.org. So Rebecca, Dennis, and Bria, thank you all so much for being on today's show. It was very informative.
My pleasure.
To stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth.
Bye-bye.